CliffCentral.com.
In 1996, I met a man called Rian van Heerden. He was the DJ manager at Radio Tux, and he gave me my first job in radio. Mm. The first show was midnight, sometime in April or May of that year. And I was shocking and I was terrible, and somehow he still thought there was potential in there.
You were not shocking and terrible.
I was terrible.
No, you were not. I'll relate this story. We were doing selections, and you walked in there with your shorts and your pluckies.
Yeah.
Student boy with your file of facts under your arm. And you filled in an application form, and I looked at it, and I saw that you do voices. And I said to you, what kind of voices do you do? And you walked over with a file of facts, and it had a whole list on it of voices that you do. Suddenly, Foghorn Leghorn, I remember.
I say, did anybody get the number of that there bus?
Hey! So I said to you, all right, so let's pick five, and the five will now debate who gets the last parachute on a crashing airplane. And you pulled it off splendidly. And I knew you were going to be a great jock. And you were. You turned out to be a great jock.
Well, listen, our careers have kind of intermingled and intertwined for many years now. It's been almost 18 years that I've known you already. Yeah, it's madness. And in fact, it must be 20 if you think about it.
But you know, did I tell you the story of how you got to be fired from Tux FM?
Did you have something to do with that? Because I always blamed it on that horrible bitch who was in charge at the time, who had hair like a pot scar. And she had a fan under her desk blowing up her skirt to keep her frigid.
I have to confess what happened. Oh, I have to confess.
All right.
Now, remember, I just retired as DJ manager, and I trained you. I selected you. And then you did the whole how long is your penis thing on the radio.
Between the black and the white guy.
Yeah, right? You did the drive show, and you asked people to phone you and tell you how long is my penis. And people phoned you, Gareth, my fool is a 7 centimeter. There you go. Yeah, you can do better than that. Come on. There should be someone out there that can do better than that. So I remember listening to that show, and I remember going, oh, my heavens.
This is a problem.
Oh, my heavens. Anyway, so the station manager phones me. She says, what do I do with this guy? So I told her, you have to fire him.
So it was you.
She had to fire you. She had to fire you. Because the problem was, everyone would do the same thing.
Yeah.
Number one. Number two, I knew it wasn't the end of your career. Like, that kind of drama that comes around with a story like that would obviously end up in the newspapers. And that's eventually you ended up at 702.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
It was the best thing that could have happened to you.
I remember the first thing I knew about you was that, I mean, you had this voice, right? You've got this just radio voice. And a lot of people don't have that. You just, that's how you talk normally. And a lot of people put on a radio voice, so they don't sound like they do in real life. But wherever you go, wherever you open your mouth, people know it's you.
Thank you.
Well, yes, absolutely. It's a great voice. But the other thing I know about you is that you can make people laugh. And I remember this from early on when we first met. You made people laugh so hard and for so long that they actually lost control of their bowels and would have stomach cramps afterwards. I remember a night where we sat in the offices at Radio Tux, and you were just telling stories, ridiculous stories about people who you'd met and things that had gone on. Do you think that skill as a storyteller is your most powerful weapon? Because it has to be right up there if it isn't the most powerful one.
The thing with Afrikaners, you know, the Afrikaner, is, and you have.
Yeah.
Is
Trosso.
Yeah, it's the storytelling ability. You know, we were.
Spice and plessis, yeah, that kind of thing.
It's usually a hell of a long story with a bad punchline. You know, it's in between, it's funny, but the punchline is always bad. That's why Afrikaners make bad stand-up comedians, with the exception of Casper.
Uh-huh.
But otherwise, we're terrible, because we want to tell a story, and there's a moose, a story, but eventually, comedy was eight. So, ek het altijd, and you know, and growing up in my life, my father used to be a great storyteller as well. Not that I'm saying I'm great at it. My growing up and being at school, what I realized is because of where I come from, I became an observer. And it's funny how things work out. I went back to my old school the other day. I went to speak to the kids, and I said to them, let me tell you how I grew up. Like, when I came into Standard 6, I had brown shoes. And in our school, you had to have black shoes. And I had glasses, of which the one lens turned brown and the other one turned blue in the sun. Remember those glasses?
No, it sounds horrible.
I told my mother they're not the same color, and she said they are, and I had to walk around like that in my brown shoes. Needless to say,
you got beaten up.
Kids didn't want to speak to me.
Yeah.
So what happens? You become an observer.
Yeah.
You watch from the sidelines. And my grandmother always used to say, don't waste money on movies. Go and observe people, see what they do, tell the stories. So it's funny how things led to me being a broadcaster. I was an observer, not by choice. It's how things worked out. And I ended up being a storyteller of what I saw.
You can very easily switch between English and Afrikaans, but I feel like if you were just born English, it might have been a whole lot easier for you.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you think that when you think about the broadcasting environment and the fact that you could have easily done any of the things I did and even more?
That's a great question. Because how it worked out for me when I went to campus radio for the first time, Afrikaans jocks did not exist. Hmm. We only had English DJs at Tux FM. So we went in there and I said, my English is so bad, I'm going to have to speak Afrikaans. Ek sal moet Afrikaans praat, jy weet. And ek het so gepraat. I had put on that voice at the beginning.
Dames
en heren. Ja. At RSG, op Radio Tux. So het ek gepraat.
Ja, ja, ja.
And I remember, I said to myself, like, I can't talk like this. I need to be myself. But because I was myself, and it's the only thing I've ever been, it led to a hell of a lot of complaints. A hell of a lot.
Yeah, you brought this up, so let's go straight to that then, because we'll come back to this English and Afrikaans thing.
Hmm.
You have been, I think you've been in trouble more than I have. It's not something you're proud of, I'm sure, because I know you.
Hmm.
I'm not proud of the things I've got into trouble for. But it's amazing how when you have a personality and you have opinions, and particularly when you know who you are, and you believe in who you are, there are a lot of people who just are not comfortable with that, right?
Yeah.
From being on Pintgesels Radio, where you broke new ground. There was no such thing as Afrikaans Talk Radio until you started doing it. When you were in the Free State on OFM,
yeah.
And you ran that morning show, you pulled up their ratings, you did wonders for them, but there were people who were burning swastikas into your lawn,
yeah.
And you can tell that story in a second, to even where you are now at Jacaranda, there's still people who are agitating because you're a problem to them. You're a problem to them when you do stand-up comedy, when you do your one-man show, where you tell your stories, which you did. Everybody loved it, but there were still people who wanted you dead.
Yeah, that's
fine. You evoke such response out of people. It's hugely complimentary in some ways, but it must be for you, it must be annoying, frustrating, and confusing. Why should you be in such cuck all the time?
Yeah, Yvette, thinking back to Pint, and I'm going to be 100% honest with you, there were times that we were quite deliberate. And this was at the very beginning. And we thought we need to push the boundaries and see how far we can push them. For the eerste keer, and Afrikaans, and I'm talking about Pint Talk, Afrikaans people had a voice which wasn't regulated by some government agency. We could speak to one another and to other people who speak Afrikaans in the country who is not of similar color.
But they were very uncomfortable about
it. Dis die moeilikheid. So for us, and I remember there was a guy called Karel Cronje. He was an ex-soldier. You know, he just came back from the war. And he went on the air one night and I'd say, Jesus is a greyhound. That was the statement. Jesus is a windhond. What do you think happens? So Ali Lehner, everything lights up. So he has this argument. And you got to give it to old Karel. You know, after being bruised and battered for 3 hours, he comes out and he says, here's my point. As far as dogs go, Jesus is right up there. A greyhound. Not a poodle, pavement special.
Right.
That was my actual point. But how he evoked debate. Now, I went out on the air, and I think back on it many times, and I said to myself, where did we get the guts to do that? Waar die guts vandaan gekom? Want for me, die een oggend het ons besluit, wat ons wil doen is, we want to talk about Bedouin women.
Mm-hmm.
And how they go to the loo. What do they do? You know, it's in the desert. So you walk behind the camel. At some point in time, you know, you need to go to the loo. So there's no porta potties there. What do you do? So I investigated and I researched it. And I found that there's a way where a Bedouin woman would use the forefinger and the middle finger to first open the outside labia and then the inside labia. And then take a wee. So my technical producer was there that day, and she said, she was in studio with me, and I said, Natasha, do you have a bucket with you? She said, yeah, in fact, would have it, I do. I said, fantastic. Do you have a loose-fitting dress on? She said, yes, I do, just like a Bedouin woman. So I say, okay, now here's what you do. You take the forefinger and the middle finger. Anyway, so meanwhile, back at the cabanas, it's radio. So she had a bucket and she had a squeezy bottle.
Sure.
So when I said, are you ready? And she did the whole thing, you know, the way the Bedouins would do it. I say, okay, do it. And she squeezed the bottle and you just heard. You can imagine. So the program manager walks in and he goes, enjoy the holiday. That's all he said. He walked in and said, enjoy the holiday. Goodbye.
No discussion.
No discussion.
No need for anything. You'd cross the line.
But I mean, looking back, imagine.
That's fantastic.
Imagine.
But it is about imagine. That's yes. A special word there is imagine.
How rough we got.
But you've done a lot of crazy things. I mean, you were just telling me now that you lost a client once because you took different kinds of boerewors and you tested them on crocodiles to see which boerewors the crocodiles liked the most.
Yeah.
And the client's boerewors was the one the crocodiles least liked.
Yeah.
And so they canned a million rand campaign.
They canned a million rand campaign. Now, you need to understand, how do you keep your bosses happy after something like that?
But your listeners loved it.
What do you do?
Your listeners loved it.
But still, you know, you have clients and they keep the radio station going. So there's a fine line in, you know, keeping everyone happy and attempting to, but also educating them and trying to test the boundaries and pushing it a bit further. And, you know, for me, it's always been about one thing. Are we a bit further along in a discussion or in a mindset than we were yesterday after today's show? And hopefully we are. Hopefully we look at things a bit differently.
If you look back on that stuff now, do you feel that what you guys were doing at Pentgesels Radio, that it was something way ahead of its time? That it was impossible to achieve what you had hope to achieve, but that it was a necessary first step?
We received a lot of death threats in that time, during that time. And specifically, remember, these were the days of Pachat and Planet Hollywood, the bomb in Cape Town.
Mm-hmm.
And we literally received a bomb threat one day. And our station manager decided everyone needs to leave immediately. But because he's the station manager, he will remain. Andre.
Like the captain on the ship.
Yeah, exactly that. And I can tell Andre, lovely man, he gave me a lot of opportunities. But Andre, you're nervous, you know what I mean? There's a bomb in the studio, for heaven's sake.
So you had a few drinks.
Anyway. So I remember then Andre didn't want to get off the air when it was the all clear. Maar ek onthou een van die polisiehonde, een van die sniffer dogs, het op die mat gekak. Ek onthou dit. Clearly. Of that day. So we were in a situation where, you know, looking back, we had 100,000 listeners at the very most.
Yeah.
But they were people that wanted to talk. They were people that wanted to meet one another halfway and wanted to discuss their fears and their angst. In that sense, it was groundbreaking what Andre Potgieter did there. It's amazing.
Yeah, but you've broken ground in so many ways too, because being an honest personality, a real character on air, instead of being someone cool, which is what radio used to be. Radio used to be all these people who sounded really cool, who could do countdowns and that kind of thing. You didn't do that. You never did that. Not from day one.
Weet jy wat sy ding, nee? Ek voel that we are human when we sit behind a microphone. We are not gods. We are not better than the people that listen to us.
And we need to show them that we also have weaknesses. So I many times discuss my own weaknesses, and I expose them when necessary. And I have no problem if anyone wants to argue with me about it or wants to point it out to me. I appreciate it. But in my opinion, a radio show can never be as slick. You know, one of those slick radio shows we all used to. It can't sound like that because in human conversation, we're not like that.
Mm-mm.
So a listener needs to sit there and go, what's going to happen next? Because it is clearly live. What's going to happen? What is he going to say? He just stumbled over a word there. It wasn't edited out.
Hmm.
It is clear to me that this guy is human, like me. He makes mistakes like me. That's why I will listen to him.
How much of that stuff that you allow your audience to know about you, that exposure,
yeah,
how much of that is also kind of protecting yourself? Because if you say something shit about yourself first, then someone else can't say it before you. Because that's what I do sometimes. I'll admit horrible things about myself because I want to say it first so that you can't nail me with it later. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a part of that, right?
I think for many years, I tried to be the perfect broadcaster. You know, I looked at guys like Fannes Rotenbach, you know, was a hero to me, like John Burks, great broadcasters. And I thought, yeah, it sounds like these guys never screw up. I gotta sound like them. I gotta make sure that my show is as slick as possible. But it got to a point where, and I think it's when I started connecting with my listeners, that I realized it wasn't an attempt to protect myself, but it was a realization that there are people that are influenced by what I say and what I do. And in that sense, you know, my humanity needs to be upfront at all times. Otherwise, I'm not going to connect with you. If I can't go out and admit the fact that my dad was an alcoholic, I cannot connect with you because there's no perfect family.
Mm.
And you can relate. And that was the thing I tried to get through to the jocks, especially the last ones that I've trained. It's important that you connect. If you don't connect with them, they will leave. So what is your job?
But that can also be very scary. I mean, that can be terrifying. You put yourself out there, and there is a chance that people will either turn from you or mock you or make it worse. And that's not the part that's going to hurt. It's that you might lose audience or that you might be judged as a failure, even though you've exposed yourself and you've talked about these things. Because that can happen too.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe the audience just think you're too real. You're too outrageous. You tell the stories that maybe should rather be kept at home. You know, especially in Afrikaans conservative culture. This is something I talk to Casper about a lot of the time. Das doen jy wat jy nie sê nie. Jy mag het nie. It's open bar, Seni. You know what I mean?
What remains?
For you, I mean, you've broken. Remember the kind of world that we were growing up in the 90s? That was a different world. Now you're not afraid. And I don't think you've ever been afraid. But for most people, that's terrifying.
Let me tell you about moments that defined me. And as an Afrikaner, you know, I am personally involved, obviously, with this group that also suffered under apartheid, that were also victims and victimized by that government. And I remember one day I was doing my maths homework and I'm sitting in my room. And on the radio they had a show called Tiener Focus. Yeah. Op die Afrikaanse dienst. And they would call in a head boy and a head girl from different schools. And they would put them on the show and they would say, okay, you know, what are you interested in and what do you like at school and what songs do you like? And I remember I'm sitting there doing my maths homework and the presenter, the aanbieder, says to the head boy, he says, what song would you like to hear? What's a leaky? And the boy goes, I would like to hear Metallica, Enter Sandman. And I remember putting on my pen, looking up, going, wow, this is great. We're breaking ground here.
Yeah.
And the presenter goes, nee. Ons kan nie dit speel nie. Wat van Cora Marie? So, ballonne in die wind. Before the guy could protest, he goes, Soos ballonne in die wind, sal my liefde jou ook vind. And I said, and I remember the anger. I remember the anger. That was the one thing.
You were furious.
I was furious. That was the one thing. The other thing is...
Because it wasn't just his song that was being said no to. It was you and every other young Afrikaner who didn't want to comply.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That was the one thing. The other thing is, I got invited a year later to debate with the state president shortly after the release of Madiba.
So it's Evie de Klerk.
Evie de Klerk. Mm-hmm. Now, remember, they phoned me at home and they said, "No, we hear you."
But is this because you were like an academic?
I could buy a rednaars gedoen.
Okay, so you were a great debater.
So they phoned me up. They say, "Would you like to come and speak debate with the president?" And I say, "Who's this? Who's this? Come on, who's phoning me?" "No, I'm so-and-so from Agenda. It's a big TV show.
Yeah.
Would like to come and debate with the president." And then I realized I'm going to meet the president, Evie de Klerk. And I ended up at the union buildings at the presidency. And I remember he's sitting there and there was someone representing the IFP and not the ANC because they weren't allowed to be there yet.
Yeah, yeah.
The IFP and there was someone from the National Party. Anyway, he sat back. Anyway, so I start, when he gets to me, I start asking him questions. It was really bothering me at that point in time. And I remember they looked at me. He said, his answer to me was...
What was your question?
I was at that point very concerned about the future of the Afrikaans culture. Because we were very concerned about what's going to happen, you know, when the transition takes place. And we were concerned about our language.
And you were what, like a school kid?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, this is prescient of you because you were able to foretell. You were kind of predicting that there would be some kind of cultural insecurity through this transition.
And I remember,
I think a lot of people thought that way then.
He looked at me and he said, "It looks to me like you are the victim of propaganda." And he said, to answer your question is unfortunately not going to be fair. And I think that I've said enough about this specific subject." And then Clarence Cater was the presenter, said, "We're going to an ad break." During the ad break, they took my damn microphone. They took it. They took my lapel mic. They took it. And they said, you've said enough. You're done."
The president shut you down.
Yes, he did. And they took my mic.
That's a hell of a place to start. That's actually the start of your broadcasting career, right?
I was 17.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And a couple of weeks later, I remember the newspaper reports, just letters to the newspaper, people that watched that show, and they said, "How dare he? How dare he not respect the president of the country?"
Oh, you were the problem.
Yeah, I was the president.
So
I was
you
the problem.
Started being a problem then already.
So they complained about me, and they said, I have no respect. I have no respect for my elders. That was 17.
But you don't, and I don't think that a lot of people would have a problem with that. You don't automatically respect people. They must earn your respect, right?
Yes, 100%. And if I look back on my life, you know, and there are certain things that certain boxes that I need to tick before I can respect you. But when you have my respect, you have my respect. It was only one time that someone lost my respect.
Oh, yeah?
For a short time there, I belonged to a cult.
What cult?
It was the White Baboon Society. Yeah.
What?
The White Baboon Society.
This is a real thing?
It was a cult, yeah.
You're talking shit.
No, I'm not.
What was the White Baboon Society?
It was a society. It was a society of people. You know,
What did you believe as the White Baboon Society?
The story was that back in the day, the farmers would paint a baboon white.
Yes.
And send it into the rest of the troop. And then it would frighten away the entire troop of baboons. And they won't steal your fruit anymore. So we believed that as the White Baboon Society, we are the people that would warn the rest of society about the things that are right and wrong in this world. Anyway, so I became a member of this.
Was this a big group?
You know, we were about 30 or 40 members.
Did you have meetings?
We had meetings, yes.
And we dress up?
We had a leader, incredible man, Christopher. Long white beard, incredible man. And I must tell you, still to today, I still respect him in a certain way.
All right. So now, what happened? Why did you lose faith in the White Baboon Society?
There was a time when we had a conversation about what's next, you know, and what should we do next. And I sat down with him and I called him Master.
Oh, really?
And he said to me, and I remember we were debating, you know, life in general. And he looked over at me and he said, "Can you lend me some money?"
Oh, shit.
And that was it.
You were out of there.
Yeah.
You don't want your master lending money from you.
I thought if you can, like, figure that bit out, at least.
You lived in Arcadia or in Hatfield for a while, and there was a place you went to that is...
Sunnyside.
Yeah. It is tattooed on the inside of my skull, your story about a place called the Chip and Strip.
Strips and Chips.
Okay, tell me what happened there, because this sounds like the kind of place a lot of people don't know exists.
Strips and Chips was a place where you could go to and see strip shows and then get a plate of chips, all for the very, very affordable price of R5.
And you mentioned to me that there was those little forks, those plastic cocktail forks that you would pick up the chips with, and you'd have tomato sauce and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But the strippers were not of great quality.
Well, you can imagine for R5 entrance, you wouldn't get the best strippers in Sunnyside to dance there. So they were mostly retired strippers who used to strip. And I remember we sat there, and our entire commune, we sat there with our plates of chips. The chips were great.
Yes.
And the stripper came on the stage, and there was a chair there, obviously, where someone could now sit down, and she would undress him. And I remember she came in, and she wanted to get up on the chair, so obviously so everyone could see her, because someone from the back was screaming, "Oska yuni sini!" And she got up on the chair, and the fan on the roof hit her against the forehead, and the stripper was out like a light. And then they gave us all extra chips.
I did a little Google search, and when you put in Rian van Heerden, it comes up with the following. You know, it always auto-completes. And I know mine are shit, so I thought I'd look yours up. Rian van Heerden married comes up first.
Really?
I think there are obviously lots of women who haven't heard the news who are still looking for you to marry them.
Obviously not.
So that comes up. Then next one is complaints.
Oh.
I would have thought that might be number one, so I was quite surprised.
Strange.
Then the next one is Rian van Heerden fired, which comes up for me as well. Then Rian van Heerden boyfriend, and then Rian van Heerden any boss. Did something happen at any boss?
Yeah.
What happened at any boss?
You know, it's Afrikaans festivals.
Yeah,
it's always some violence.
This one's in like Nelspruit or something, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nothing I'm too proud of, but it happened.
What happened?
We were in a fight, any boss.
Proper full-on fist fight.
Yeah, the McDonald's.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, a friend of mine reversed into someone's car at the drive-thru. And I remember he got out, and these three boys were, you know, three sheets to the wind. And it got quite violent outside. I remember sitting there going, am I going to get out now and get my hamburger, because I'm here for a hamburger. I'm going to run screaming into the felt, or are we going to have to sort this out? So I wasn't strong myself, you know, when it comes to the drink. And I got out and I walked up to the first guy and I uttered these famous words, "Will ye met me dance?" And he did want to dance with me, and he's much better than me at dancing. So yeah.
Did he knock you out?
No, he did break my nose, though.
Yes, and,
but...
That's not lekker, but do these things happen at Afrikaans festivals?
It happens. Now and then, not always.
I haven't been, so maybe I shouldn't go.
No, you should.
No,
You'll be quite popular.
I might have wanted to. Now, the interesting thing about you, I mean, there are lots of interesting things about you, but with all these radio jobs, you and I have always had arguments with management. We've always found that management are trying to control, trying to tell you how to do your show, telling you how you could have done this better or that better. Often these are not people, though, who have any idea of how to do the show themselves.
Mm.
Do you feel that that's improved at all? Or are you still frustrated, no matter where you are in the world, that radio management are some of the worst people on earth?
I think it boils down to one thing, in my opinion, when it comes to radio shows. Are you bringing in money, yes or no?
Uh-huh.
So as long as a show keeps making money, you have more freedom.
And at the moment, you have a huge audience on Jacaranda with the complimentary breakfast. How many million people are listening every morning? I mean, it's a lot.
Well, Jacaranda itself has 2 million listeners.
Fantastic.
Which is quite large. I think they're the biggest commercial station.
Yeah.
And I must give it to the radio station because, you know, guys like Omar Ishaq took a massive risk with me. Hmm. The director of broadcasting, he took a massive risk. Remember where I come from, and you can just Google me and you'll know.
Hmm.
But he was in the Free State, and we had this conversation. He said, I believe that you might be able to pull off this show, and I think you'll do it. And through all the years, the guy stood by me. And eventually, you know, we got to a point where we left the rough waters and the sailing became smoother. And it's at that point when you realize, wow, whew, you know, no one's giving me the kind of grief that they used to do.
So you could pick up the phone now and you could say to him, listen, I feel like doing this thing. I'm not sure it's going to work. Will you support me? Or even worse, after you've done something,
yeah,
you might want to call him and say, hey, listen, I did this thing this morning. You're going to get some noise from the middle management.
Yeah, I think you'll always have people on a management that do not believe in what you do and that might be very hesitant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, I believe in that philosophy. And like I said, I've learned many lessons. And you would know, after you've paid enough money at the BCCSA, and I pay it personally, you go, maybe I should watch my step. And also, it's not just about me. Remember, I've got an entire team around me.
Yeah. And so, then they could lose their jobs, exactly. So you feel bad for them. What are the things that have got you into the most trouble?
I was sued for R500,000 a few years ago. It was R500,000. I paid 50.
For what?
You know, that was actually Tux FM.
You're kidding?
Yeah. It was a journalist, and the two of us, let's put it like this, we had disagreements.
Uh-huh.
And I went on the air that morning, and, you know, she wrote things about me that wasn't true.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, all right, you're using your medium, I'm going to use my medium.
Right.
And I went out and I said, all right, listen to me now, very carefully. Her car is a brown Toyota Corolla.
Yeah.
No, it was a yellow Toyota Corolla. Yeah. It is parked outside this newspaper's offices. Do me a favor and go and take a shit on her bonnet.
And people did.
Yeah, yeah.
So how many shits were on her bonnet?
I'm not sure. I know about one. But apparently this is called incitement to violence.
Oh, hell. So you this was criminally...
Well, luckily they didn't go that far. She charged me civilly and sued me for R500,000. And I paid 50.
Well, for a journalist, 50 is the equivalent of, for you, R500,000.
Yeah, it was a fortune.
So
back
she's
in the
still
day.
Living on that.
Still good money spent.
But you don't mind, you know, again, let's go back to the Free State, because you told me the story of how, first of all, you had a giraffe as a pet.
Yeah. Yeah.
I heard this from another mutual friend of ours.
Yeah.
Charles, who told me he went to visit you.
Yeah.
And you actually had a giraffe as a pet.
Yes. He would come over. It took me a while, but I trained him. You would call him. He would be somewhere in the felt and would come running through the bush. It's amazing to see. He'd come right up to you and you can pet him. It's amazing. Yeah, he's dead now.
Was he hunted?
No, he got some disease. Oh, you know, some of those giraffe diseases. Terrible.
Terrible stuff. But someone did burn a swastika into your lawn because of things that you were saying that they didn't agree with on OFM.
Yeah, there was a.
I mean, that's like those movies you see in America with like Mississippi Burning, and the guy comes out and there's, you know, they set the cross on fire in his yard.
There were a couple of right wingers that were not impressed with what I had to say. We were talking about this specific right winger that was on a hunger strike. He was on a hunger strike,
mm-hmm.
And he lost a lot of weight. And we were talking about diets that morning. And I thought that this guy's diet is really the best way to go for it. So I said, if you lose some weight, this is what you need to do. And they were not impressed with me making jokes about the hunger strike. So I left for Pretoria that weekend. And when I came back, there was and I remember, you know, it's the weirdest thing because your eyes, what your eyes see, you cannot believe. Remember, I was standing on the stoop of my house and I was looking at my lawn. And I thought, this wasn't here. What is it? And then it clicked. It's a damn swastika burned into my lawn. Now, try to explain that to people coming to visit you. I mean, try to explain
that
away.
Before you worry about that, Did you think to call the police? Did you think...
I didn't
feel afraid, personally, like your personal security. Because if they could burn a swastika onto your lawn, they could get into your house and kill you.
Let me tell you one thing, Gary.
Death threats don't frighten you.
Let me tell you one thing. I've had several death threats in my life. Not one, not two, several. One thing I realize is when people threaten you with death, when people phone you and say, I'm going to kill you, obviously they don't act on it. The people you need to be careful of are the people that don't phone you and tell you, I'm going to kill you. So I had my first death threat in probably 99, around there. And we were talking about the TRC. And we're reporting back on the evidence in front of the TRC. And I remember one guy was testifying about ice cubes used to be by these security cops or these special branch cops.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to use ice cubes and they would insert it into prisoners.
Through the asshole?
Anally,
okay, yeah.
In a way of torturing them. I remember we were talking about it, and it was extremely hectic to me, and I said, I cannot believe human beings would do this to one another. I cannot fathom the concept. And that night, I was sitting in my flat in Sunnyside when my phone rang, and the guy said to me, is it Van Heerden? And I said, yes, it's Rian Van Heerden. And he said, I can see you. He said, I'm watching you now as we speak, and you listen to me very carefully. We never inserted ice cubes into anyone's poop ball, he said. He said, Axinio. So he said, you know, Darston, yes, you're standing in front of the window. I can see you. I'm watching you. And he put the phone down. And I remember that was the only time I was really scared. I thought, someone is watching me. It was the only time. After that, never again.
You studied law. And you went and you did your articles and everything too, but you didn't practice. I've heard, with you, there are just so many myths and legends accumulating. And it's probably because people know that we have a history together and we've worked together before at Radio Tux and that you put me on air and all that stuff. But I heard a story, I don't know if it's true, that you told the judge to fuck off and you were disbarred. Is that true?
No.
Here's what I heard. I heard that you went to court. It was one of your first appearances. It was some small, probably some pro bono thing in the beginning. I don't remember the detail, but that you went and the judge was annoying you. And you said something like, "Ieer de limit, alle respect, fuck you." Is that true?
I heard that story as well, but
so someone's making this stuff up.
Yeah, I was altered lot. I was always late. So I was a terrible lawyer.
Uh-huh.
So I actually practiced for about 3 or 4 months, you know, after I was admitted as an attorney. But I was terrible. And I remember these motions. Tuesdays were always motions in the magistrate's court. And I was always late. I tried my best. Yeah. I was always late. And the magistrate would go, "See, Meneer Van Heerden is here, so we can start now. Thank you very much." So that was about it. And I did fight one case. I had a client and everything. Yeah.
Did you win?
No, I remember. I did. Thank you, God. Thank you, magistrate. Because the magistrate said, actually, no, you can't say that, sir, to the other side. No, where's your article, this and this document?
Yeah.
And then he said, no, case thrown out. And obviously, I claimed that I won that case. But I was in court for a client for a case, and I won it. Thank you.
Do you feel that it's more difficult than it's ever been at the moment to be funny and to talk about things that are relevant without upsetting everybody, because it seems everyone is super sensitive at the moment?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked that question. I had the most amazing evening last night. We got together, and this was a thing arranged by Rolf Meyer. And we got together, and no one knew who the other person was. It was just people from all walks of life. And I remember sitting in a group, and it was me and a Dutch guy, and two black guys, the four of us. And we started talking about what can we do to alleviate the situation. What can I do as an individual to help make things better in this country? And we had this discussion, and I remember the humor that came out of it. How we laughed about things that you think, well, that's serious. Yeah. But the way in which we got to the solutions was in a funny way. So we were talking about, for instance, how much money we spent that could go to a family. You know, for instance, how much money we spent that could go to a bursary. So we're talking about how much money did you spend last Friday night on drinks and food. And that led to a discussion about the one guy's suit. Like, how much is that suit? Mm-hmm. That looks about 5 grand. And he goes, no, it's 10.
So, yeah, he's upset.
Which led to a lot of humor. And I thought that is the answer. We will solve the problems through humor. And as I left there, I thought, this is the way forward. That is, this is where we connect. If we cannot laugh about it, that's the thing about South Africa.
Is this the White Baboon Society?
No. No. Rolf Meyer does not belong to the White Baboon Society. I would have known.
But it is so good. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And every day you do what you do, and there's a lot of humor, and I think you're helping people to cope.
Let me, once again, I'm glad you pointed that out, because that is my job. But you you need to understand, and I'm talking on behalf of Afrikaners now, and then looking at our own culture. After the Anglo-Boer War, when all those farms were burned down,
and all those people were in concentration camps, and there was trauma, there was serious trauma,
you would still find humor. In amongst all of that, you would find humor. And that's who we are, South Africans. We can find the humor in the worst of situations. And there's a story that, and this is it's apparently true, where this old farmer is lying on his deathbed. And he's surrounded by everyone, all the workers and all the family, everyone surrounding his bed. Mm. And this is, like I say, apparently a true story. And all surrounding his bed, and it's his last moments. And he looks up at everyone around him, and he goes, "Wat mag julle almal nou hier? What are all of you doing here?" And his wife goes, "Papa, let net kom groet. They just came to say goodbye." And he goes, "Where are all of them going then?" You know, that's how we find humor and everything. It's the key.
Let's talk about Afrikaans people for a second, because I have a deep and abiding love for the Afrikaner. I think that there's something very special there. Mm. There's a pioneering spirit and an adventure spirit that is insurmountable. And there's a kind of fighter in the Afrikaans nation that I don't think you'll be able to quell easily. It's part of the reason that they stood defiantly against the world. Even though they were badly informed and they had kaka ideas, they stood up and they made themselves counted. You know what I mean? Mm. And they were a minority, and they were throwaways from Europe, and there were lots of things that they had to deal with. But there's a part of Afrikaans culture that I think you maybe understand better than many. The only other people I'd say who get it are people like Casper de Vries. Because you find yourself becoming enemy number one, despite the fact that you're in the tribe, just because of the things you say that the conservative people in the tribe don't like to hear.
I think, number one, just to add to what you just said about the Afrikaners, I think to me it's extremely important that we know our history in detail, our country's history, but also our people's history. And there are many things I did not know about the Afrikaner that I only found out recently. So there are all these things that, and I'll start by pointing out the fact that for some reason, all those years, I thought at Blood River, there were women and children as well. And for some reason, I had heard the story that the women were loading the rifles, and it's not true. There were only men there. There wasn't a single woman or a single child there. So things like this, when you really go into your history and you find out more, why are we so scared of one another? Why do we not trust one another? Where does this come from?
When you say one another, do you mean Afrikaners and
black people?
Right?
Black people, okay. Specifically. Yeah. I mean, and then you go right back. If you take it right back to
It's my four-greats grandfather who was murdered at Ngongondlovu on that hill, KwaMatiwan.
Yeah. He
was very. That you still. You imagine the scene, and I can only imagine how it feels to people who've grown up in a very strict Calvinist upbringing, where there's lots of guilt and there's lots of suffering that's piled upon you at an early age, and you're told that guilt and suffering are things that they will make you noble.
Yeah, Mano, you need to take it back all the way to 1836, 1835, that mm-hmm. period, just before the Great Trek.
Okay.
And you see that the amount of Afrikaners that actually left the Cape Town area, you would think it is thousands, about 3,000.
Not a lot.
And they all left from the Eastern Cape area, close to the Fish River. That's mm-hmm. why they left, because of clashes with the local people.
Us across the river.
That's
yeah.
where it started. So now, you know, we're gonna find somewhere where we don't have violence. We're gonna find somewhere where, you know, we're not governed by the English. You know, things like that. And how people made these decisions and then decided we're gonna move, and then they ended up somewhere in the middle of South Africa. But now you ask where the distrust comes from both sides. You know, you've got to know your history.
Yeah.
You've got to know where it originated. Why are we distrusting one another? Where's this coming from? Right back in the day, when that's how people, it's always in the blood. You know, you know these things. There was research done about this fear that is in the blood.
Yeah, it's called epigenetics.
It's to do with
this inherited fear. I was talking to Rabbi Yossi Goldman earlier about how the Holocaust epigenetically has affected the descendants of survivors.
Exactly.
So absolutely, exactly that makes that. Sense. And we all carry so much baggage.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you carry baggage? Because you seem able to turn it into humor very quickly and easily.
No, of course not.
You're one of those angry Steve Hofmeyr Afrikaners who wants to... And it must irritate you that you get lumped with people like that sometimes.
Yeah, the thing is, you know, I make it a point of it, of distancing myself from people like Steve Hofmeyr. I make a point of it. And I must say, as a person that used to be one of my greatest friends, it was disappointing to see how he became the person that he tried to move away from.
You don't talk to him now?
No.
And he doesn't like you now?
I don't know. I can't speak on his behalf. But what I'm saying is, you know, it was unfortunate because we had a close relationship. Mm. And he became the person that he didn't like himself. Mm. So, you know, for me, I think what we need to be doing, and, you know, luckily I see a lot more people, a lot more open-minded people. You know, you would share things on, as you would know, on Facebook and Twitter, and you would think, I'm the only one that thinks like this, and then you realize you're not. Mm. But what we do need to remember, and I think Rolf Meyer put it very eloquently, he said, the breakthrough came in 1994, when we all said to one another, what do we collectively want in the future? Not what we want to hang on to from the past. That's how you make things work.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end this discussion, because first of all, we're out of time, and we could carry on all day. I could talk to you all day. I have before, and it's never boring. You are one of the most interesting, intelligent, funny, and talented people I've ever had the privilege to know. And I've got to tell you, on behalf of young South Africans, whether they're Afrikaans or English, that you've taught to embrace the sense of humor. You've done probably more for culture than a lot of people who proclaim themselves to be terrifically important to where this country is at the moment. And you continue to do it daily. I must tell you, you're a hero.
Wow. Thank you so much. Coming from you, it's a huge compliment. And now I have to invite you to come onto my show.
Seker, Bierman.
Wonderlijk.
Seker. Maar baie dankie.
Thanks for having me.
Rian van Heerden. CliffCentral.com.